So Sonny does. What else is he going to do? The guy on the mound is one of the best pitchers in baseball, and the guy behind the plate was maybe playing a little pickup ball behind the barn that spring to keep in shape after the day's cow tits was all pulled. First pitch? God damn! Williams takes off for second. The ball was in the dirt, hard to handle, but the kid still made one fuck of a good throw. Almost got Teddy, but as you know, almost only counts in horseshoes. Now everybody's on their feet, screaming. The dude does some shouting at the kid, like it was the kid's fault instead of just a bullshit pitch. And while dude's telling the kid he's a lousy choker, Williams calls time. Hurt his knee a little, sliding into the bag, which shouldn't have surprised anyone. He could hit like nobody's business, but he was a lead foot on the bases. Why he stole a bag that day is anybody's guess. It sure wasn't no hit and run, not with two outs and the game on the line. So Billy Anderson comes in to run for Teddy, who probably would have been royally roasted by the manager if he'd been anyone but Teddy. And Dick Gernert steps in, .425 slugging percentage or something like it. The crowd's going apeshit. The flag's blowing out, the Frank rappers are swirling around, women are goddamn crying, men are yelling for Jersey Joe to yank the do and put in Stu Rankin. He was what people would call the closer today, although back then he was just known as a short relief specialist. But Joe crossed his fingers and stuck with Deuson. The count goes 3-2, right? Anderson? Off with the pitch, right? Because he can run like the wind, and the guy behind the plate's a first-game rook. Gernert, that mighty man, gets just under a curve and beeps it. Not bloops it, but beeps it. Behind the pitcher's mound, just out of the dude's reach. He's on it like a cat, though. Anderson's around third, and the dude throws home from his knees. That thing was a fucking bullet! I know what you're thinking, I'm thinking, Mr. King, but you're dead wrong. It never crossed my mind that our new rookie catcher was going to get busted up like Faraday and have a nice one-game career in the bigs. For one thing, Billy Anderson was no moose like Big Clue, more of a ballet dancer. For another, well, the kid was better than Faraday. I think I knew that the first time I saw him sitting on the bumper of his beshitted old truck with his wore-out gear stored in the back. Deuson's throw was low, but on the money. The kid took it between his legs, then pivoted around, and I seen he was holding out just the mitt. I just had time to think of what a rookie mistake that was, how he forgot that old saying, two hands for beginners, how Anderson was going to knock the ball loose and we'd have to try to win the game in the bottom of the ninth. But then the kid lowered his left shoulder like a football lineman. I never paid attention to his free hand because I was staring at that outstretched catcher's mitt, just like everyone else in Old Swampy that day. So I didn't exactly see what happened. And neither did anybody else. What I saw was this. The kid whapped the glove on Anderson's chest while he was still three full steps from the dish. Then Anderson hit the kid's lowered shoulder. He went up and over and landed behind the left-hand batter's box. The umpire lifted his fist in the out sign. Then Anderson started to yell and grab his ankle. I could hear it from the far end of the dugout, so you know it must have been good yelling because those opening day fans were roaring like a force 10 gale. I could see that Anderson's left pants cuff was turning red, and blood was oozing out between his fingers. Can I have a drink of water? Just pour some out of the plastic pitcher there. Would you? Thank you. Plastic pitchers is all they give us for our rooms, you know. No glass pitchers allowed in the zombie hotel. Ah, oh, yeah, that's good. It's been a long time since I talked so much. And I got a lot more to say. You bored yet? No? Good. Me neither. Having the time of my life. Awful story or not. Anderson didn't play again until 58, and 58 was his last year. Boston gave him his unconditional release halfway through the season, and he couldn't catch on with anyone else because his speed was gone, and speed was really all he had to sell. The doc said he'd be good as new. The Achilles tendon was only nicked, not cut all the way through, but it was also stretched, and I imagine that's what finished him. Baseball's a tender game, you know. People don't realize. And it isn't only catchers who get hurt in collisions at the plate. After the game, Danny Du grabs the kid in the shower and yells, "I'm going to buy you a drink tonight, Rook. In fact, I'm going to buy you 10. And then he gives his highest praise. "You hung the fuck in there! 10 drinks because I hung the fuck in there," the kid says. And the dude laughs and claps him on the back like it's the funniest thing he ever heard. But then Pinky Higgins comes storming in. He was managing the Red Sox that year, which was a thankless job. Things only got worse for Pinky and the Sox as the summer of 57 crawled along. He was mad as hell, chewing a wad of tobacco so hard and fast the juice squirted from both sides of his mouth and ran down his chin. He said the kid had deliberately cut Anderson's ankle when they collided at the plate. Said Blakely must have done it with his fingernails, and the kid should be put out of the game for it. This was pretty rich, coming from a man whose motto was "spikes high and let 'em die." I was sitting in Joe's office drinking a beer, so the two of us listened to Pinky's rant together. I thought the guy was nuts, and I could see from Joe's face that I wasn't alone. Joe waited until Pinky ran down, then said, "I wasn't watching Anderson's foot. I was watching to see if Blakely made the tag and held on to the ball, which he did." "Get him in here," Pinky fumes. "I want to see it to his face." "Be reasonable, Pink," Joe says. "Would I be in your office doing a tantrum if it had been Blakely all cut up?" "It wasn't spikes," Pinky yells. "Spikes are a part of the game. Scratching someone up like a girl at a kickball match, that ain't. And Anderson's in the game 7 years. He's got a family to support." "So you're saying what? My catcher ripped your pinch runner's ankle open while he was tagging him out and tossing him over his goddamn shoulder, don't forget. And he did it with his nails?" "That's what Anderson says," Pinky tells him. "Anderson says he felt it." "Maybe Blakely stretched Anderson's foot with his nails, too. Is that it?" "No," Pinky admits. His face was all red by then, and not just from being mad. He knew how it sounded. "He says that happened when he came down." "Begging the court's pardon," I says. "But fingernails? This is a load of crap." "I want to see the kid's hands," Pinky says. "You show me, or I'll lodge a goddamn protest." I thought Joe would tell Pinky to shit in his hat, but he didn't. He turned to me. "Tell the kid to come in here. Tell him he's going to show Mr. Higgins his nails. Just like he did to his first grade teacher after the Pledge of Allegiance." I got the kid. He came willingly enough, although he was just wearing a towel, and didn't hold back showing his nails. They were short, clean, not broken, not even bent. There were no blood blisters either, like there might be if you really set them in someone and raked with them. One little thing I did happen to notice, although I didn't think anything of it at the time. The Band-Aid was gone from his second finger, and I didn't see any sign of a healing cut where it had been. Just clean skin, pink from the shower.
"Satisfied?" Joe asked Pinky. "Or would you like to check his ears for potato dirt while you're at it?"
"Fuck you," Pinky says. He got up, stamped over to the door, spat his cud into the waste paper basket there, spoop, and then he turns back. "My boy says your boy cut him, says he felt it, and my boy don't lie."
"Your boy tried to be a hero with the game on the line instead of stopping at third and giving Pearsall a chance. He'd tell you the moon was made of his father's cum-stained skivvies if it'd get him off the hook for that. You know what happened, and so do I. Anderson got tangled in his own spikes and did it to himself when he went whoopsie-daisy. Now get out of here."
"There'll be a payback for this, DePano."
"Yeah? Well, it's the same game time tomorrow. Get here early."
Pinky left, already tearing off a fresh piece of chew.
Joe drummed his fingers beside his ashtray, then asked the kid, "Now that it's just us chickens, did you do anything to Anderson? Tell me the truth."
"No." Not a bit of hesitation. "I didn't do anything to Anderson. That's the truth."
"Okay," Joe said and stood up. "Always nice to shoot the shit after a game, but I think I'll go on home and have a drink. Then I might fuck my wife on the sofa. Winning on opening day always makes my pecker stand up."
Then he said, "Kid, you played the game the way it's supposed to be played. Good for you." He left. The kid cinched his towel around his waist and started back to the locker room. I said, "I see that shaving cut's all better." He stopped dead in the doorway, and although his back was to me, I knew he'd done something out there. The truth was in the way he was standing. I don't know how to explain it better, but I knew.
"What?"
Like he didn't get me, you know. "The shaving cut on your finger?"
"Oh, that shaving cut. Yep, all better."
And out he sails. Although rube that he was, he probably didn't have a clue where he was going. Luckily for him, Kerwin McCaslin had got him a place to stay in the better part of Newark. Hard to believe as it may be, Newark had a better part back then.
Okay, second game of the season. Dandy Dave Sisler on the mound for Boston, and our new catcher is hardly settled into the batter's box before Sisler chucks a fastball at his head.
Would have knocked his fucking eyes out if it had connected, but he snaps his head back, didn't duck or nothing, and then just cocks his bat again, looking at Sisler as if to say, "Go on, Mac, do it again if you want." The crowd's screaming like mad and chanting, "Run him, run him, run him." The ump didn't run Sisler, but he got warned, and a cheer went up. I looked over and saw Pinky in the Boston dugout walking back and forth with his arms folded so tight he looked like he was trying to keep from exploding. Sisler walks twice around the mound, soaking up the fan love. Boy, oh boy, they wanted him drawn and quartered. And then he went to the rosin bag, and then he shook off two or three signs, taking his time, you know, letting it sink in. The kid all the time just standing there, with his bat cocked, comfortable as old Tilly. So Dandy Dave throws a get-me-over fastball right down Broadway, and the kid loses it in the left-field bleachers. Tidings was on base, and we're up, 2-0. I bet the people over in New York heard the noise from Swampy when the kid hit that home run. I thought he'd be grinning when he came around third, but he looked just as serious as a judge. Under his breath, he's muttering, "Got it done, Billy. Showed that busher and got it done." The Dew was the first one to grab him in the dugout and danced him right into the bat rack. Helped him pick up the spilled lumber, too, which was nothing like Danny Dusen, who usually thought he was above such things. After beating Boston twice and pissing off Pinky Higgins, we went down to Washington and won 3 straight. The kid hit safe in all three, including his second home run. But Griffith Stadium was a depressing place to play, brother. You could have gunned down a running rat in the box seats behind home plate and not had to worry about hitting any fans. Goddamn Senators finished over 40 games back that year. 40! Jesus fucking wept. The kid was behind the plate for the Dew's second start down there, and damn near caught a no-hitter in his 5th game wearing a big league uniform. Pete Runnels spoiled it in the 9th, hit a double with one out. After that, the kid went out to the mound, and that time, Danny didn't wave him back. They discussed it a little bit, and then the Dew gave an intentional pass to the next batter. Lou Berberet. See how it all comes back? That brought up Bob Usher, and he hit into a double play, just as sweet as you could ever want. Ball game. That night, the Dew and the kid went out to celebrate Dusen's 198th win. When I saw our newest chick the next day, he was very badly hungover, But he bore that as calmly as he bore having Dave Sisler chuck at his head. I was starting to think we had a real big leaguer on our hands and wouldn't be needing Hubie Ratner after all, or anybody else. "You and Danny are getting pretty tight, I guess," I says.
"Tight," he agrees, rubbing his temples. "Me and the Dew are tight." He says Billy's his good luck charm.
"Does he now?"
"Yep. He says if we stick together, he'll win 25 and they'll have to give him the Cy Young."
"Is that right?"
"Yes, sir, that's right." "Granny?"
"What?"
He was giving me that wide blue stare of his, 20/20 vision that saw everything and understood practically nothing. By then I knew he could hardly read, and the only movie he'd ever seen was Bambi. He said he went with the other kids from Otter Show or Outer Show, yeah, whatever, and I assumed it was his school. I was both right and wrong about that, but it ain't really the point. The point is that he knew how to play baseball, instinctively, I'd say, but otherwise, he was a blackboard with nothing written on it. What's a Cy Young? That's how he was, you see.
We went over to Baltimore for 3 before going back home. Typical spring baseball in that town, which isn't quite south or north. Cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey the first day. Hotter than hell the second. A fine drizzle, like liquid ice, the third. Didn't matter to the kid. He hit in all 3 games, making it 8 straight. Also, he stopped another runner at the plate. We lost the game, but it was a hell of a stop. Gus Triandos was the victim, I think. He ran headfirst into the kid's knees and just lay there, stunned, 3 feet from home. The kid put the tag on the back of his neck, just as gentle as mommy patting oil on baby deer's sunburn. There was a picture of that put out in the Newark Evening News with a caption reading, "Blockade Billy Blakely saves another run." It was a good nickname, and caught on with the fans. They weren't as demonstrative in those days. Nobody would have come to Yankee Stadium in 57 wearing a chef's hat to support Gary Sheffield, I don't think. But when we played our first game back at Old Swampy, some of the fans came in carrying orange road signs, reading "Detour" and "Road Closed." The signs might have been a one-day thing if 2 Indians hadn't gotten thrown out at the plate in our first game back. That was a game Danny Duson pitched, incidentally. Both of those putouts were the result of great throws rather than great blocks, but the Rook got the credit anyway, and I'd say he deserved it. The guys were starting to trust him, see? And they wanted to watch him do it. Baseball players are fans, too. And when someone's on a roll, even the most hard-hearted try to help. Deuson got his 199th that day. Oh, and the kid went 3 for 4, including a home run. So it shouldn't surprise you that even more people showed up with those signs for our second game against Cleveland. By the third one, some enterprising fellow was selling them out on Titan Esplanade. Big orange cardboard diamonds with black letters. "Road closed by order of Blockade Billy." Some of the fans would hold them up when Blockade Billy was at bat, and they'd all hold them up when the other team had a runner on third. By the time the Yankees came to town, this was going on to the end of April. The whole stadium would flush orange when the Bombers had a runner on third, which they did, often in that series, because the Yankees kicked the living shit out of us and took over first place. It was no fault of the kids. He hit in every game and tagged out Bill Scourin between home and third when the lug got caught in a rundown. Scourin was a moose the size of Big Clue, and he tried to flatten the kid. But it was Scourin who went on his ass, the kid straddling him with a knee on either side.
The photo of that one in the paper made it look like the end of a big-time wrestling match with pretty Tony Baba for once finishing off gorgeous George instead of the other way around. The crowd outdid themselves waving those road closed signs around. It didn't seem to matter that the Titans had lost. The fans went home happy because they'd seen our skinny catcher knock Mighty Moose Scourin on his ass. I seen the kid afterwards sitting naked on the bench outside the showers. He had a big bruise coming on the side of his chest, but he didn't seem to mind it at all. He was no crybaby. The son of a bitch was too dumb to feel pain, some people said later. Too dumb and crazy. But I've known plenty of dumb players in my time, and being dumb never stopped them from bitching over their boo-boos. How about all those signs, kid? I asked, thinking I would cheer him up if he needed cheering. What signs? He says, and I could see by the puzzled look on his face that he wasn't joking a bit. That was Blockade Billy for you. He would have stood in front of a semi if the guy behind the wheel was driving down the third baseline and trying to score on him, but otherwise, he didn't have a fucking clue. We played a two-game series with Detroit before hitting the road again, and lost both. Danny Dew was on the mound for the second one, and he couldn't blame the kid for the way it went. He was gone before the third inning was over, sat in the dugout whining about the cold weather. It wasn't cold. The way Harrington misplayed a fly ball out in right. Harrington would have needed rockets on his heels to get to that one before it dropped. And the bad calls he got from that son of a bitch Wenders behind the plate. On that last one, he might have had a point. High Wenders didn't like the Dew, never had. Ran him in two ball games the year before. But I didn't see any bad calls that day, and I was standing less than 90 feet away. The kid hit safe in both games, including a home run and a triple. Nor did Deuson hold the hot bat against him, which would have been his ordinary behavior. He was one of those guys who wanted fellows to understand there was one big star on the Titans, and it wasn't them. But he liked the kid. He really seemed to think the kid was his lucky charm. And the kid liked him. They went bar hopping after the game, had about 1,000 drinks, and visited a whorehouse to celebrate the Dew's first loss of the season, and showed up the next day for the trip to KC, pale and shaky. The kid got laid last night, Dew confided in me as we rode out to the airport in the team bus. I think it was his first time. That's the good news. The bad news is that I don't think he remembers it. We had a bumpy plane ride. Most of them were back then. Lousy prop-driven buckets. It's a wonder we didn't all get killed like Buddy Holly and the big fucking bopper. The kids spent most of the trip throwing up in the can at the back of the plane, while right outside the door a bunch of guys sat playing AC Deucey and tossing them the usual funny stuff. Get any on ya? Want a fork and knife to cut that up a little? Then the next day, the son of a bitch goes 5 for 5 at Municipal Stadium, including a pair of jacks. There was also another Blockade Billy play. By then, he could have taken out a patent. This time, the victim was Cleet Boyer. Again, it was Blockade Billy, down with the left shoulder, and up and over Mr. Boyer went, landing flat on his back in the left batter's box. There were some differences, though. The rook used both hands on the tag, and there was no bloody foot or strained Achilles tendon. Boyer just got up, walked back to the dugout, dusting his ass and shaking his head like he didn't quite know where he was. Oh, and we lost the game, in spite of the kid's 5 hits. 11-10 was the final score, or something like that. Gansey Burgess's knuckleball wasn't dancing that day. The Athletics feasted on it. We won the next game, lost a squeaker on getaway day. The kid hit in both games, which made it 16 straight, plus 9 putouts at the plate. 9 in 16 games. That might be a record. If it was in the books, that is. If any of that month's records were in the books. We went to Chicago for 3, and the kid hit in those games too, making it 19 straight. But damn if we didn't lose all 3. Jersey Joe looked at me after the last of those games and said, "I don't buy that Lucky Charm stuff. I think Blakely sucks luck."
"That ain't fair, and you know it," I said. "We were going good at the start, and now we're in a bad patch. It'll even out."
"Maybe," he says. "Is Deuson still trying to teach the kid how to drink?"
"Yeah, they're headed off to the loop with some other guys."
"But they'll come back together," Joe says. "I don't get it. By now, Deuson should hate that kid. Deuce's been here 5 years, and I know his M.O.
I did, too. When the Deuce lost, he had to lay the blame on somebody else. Like that bum Johnny Harrington, or that busher blue suit, High Wenders. The kid's turn in the barrel was overdue. But Danny was still clapping him on the back and promising him he'd be rookie of the goddamn year. Not that the Deuce could blame the kid for that day's loss. In the fifth inning of his latest masterpiece, Danny had hucked one to the backstop in the fifth. High, wide, and handsome. That scored one. So then he gets mad, loses his control, and walks the next two. Then Nellie Fox doubled down the line. After that, the Deuce got it back together, but by then it was too late. He was on the hook and stayed there. We got a little well in Detroit, took 2 out of 3. The kid hit in all 3 games and made another one of those amazing home plate stands. Then we flew home. By then, the kid from the Davenport Cornholers was the hottest goddamn thing in the American League. There was talk of him doing a Gillette ad.
"That's an ad I'd like to see," Cy Barbarino said. "I'm a fan of comedy."
"And you must love looking at yourself in the mirror," Critter Hayward said.
"You're a cod," Cy says. "What I mean is the kid ain't got no whiskers."
There never was an ad, of course. Blockade Billy's career as a baseball player was almost over.
We just didn't know it.
We had 3 scheduled at home with the White Sox, but the first one was a washout. The Deuce's old pal, High Wenders, was the umpire crew chief, and he gave me the news himself. I'd got to the swamp early because the trunks with our road uniforms in them got sent to Idlewild by mistake, and I wanted to make sure they'd been trucked over. We wouldn't need him for a week, but I was never easy in my mind until such things were taken care of. Wenders was sitting on a little stool outside the umpire's room, reading a paperback with a blonde in step-ins on the cover. "That your wife, High?" I asks.
"My girlfriend," he says. "Go on home, Granny. Weather forecast says that by 3 it's going to be coming down in buckets. I'm just waiting for DePuno and Lopez to get here so I can call the game."
"Okay," I says. "Thanks." I started away, and he called after me.
"Granny, is that wonder kid of yours all right in the head? Because he talks to himself behind the plate. Whispers. Never fucking shuts up."
"He's no quiz kid, but he's not crazy, if that's what you mean," I said. I was wrong about that, but who knew?
"What kind of stuff does he say?" "I couldn't hear much the one time I was behind him. The second game against Boston. But I know he talks about himself in that, third person. He says stuff like, 'I can do it, Billy.' And one time when he dropped a foul tip that would have been strike 3, he goes, 'I'm sorry, Billy.'"
"Well, so what? Till I was 5, I had an invisible friend named Sheriff Pete. Me and Sheriff Pete shot up a lot of mining towns together."
"Yeah, but Blakely ain't 5 anymore. Unless he's 5 up here."
Wenders taps the side of his thick skull. "He's apt to have a 5 as the first number in his batting average before long," I says. "That's all I care about. Plus, he's a hell of a stopper. You have to admit that."
"I do," Wenders says. "That little cockknocker has no fear. Another sign that he's not all there in the head."
I wasn't going to listen to an umpire run down one of my players any more than that, so I changed the subject and asked him, joking but not joking, if he was going to call the game tomorrow fair and square, even though his favorite Doobug was throwing.
"I always call it fair and square," he says. "Deuson's a conceited glory hog who's got his spot all picked out in Cooperstown. He'll do 100 things wrong and never take the blame once,
And he's an argumentative son of a bitch who knows better than to start in with me because I won't stand for it. That said, I'll call it straight up just like I always do. I can't believe you'd ask.
And I can't believe you'd sit there scratching your ass and calling our catcher next door to a congenital idiot, I thought, but you did.
I took my wife out to dinner that night, and we had a very nice time. Danced to Lester Lannon's band, as I recall. Got a little romantic in the taxi afterward. Slept well. I didn't sleep well for quite some time afterward. Lots of bad dreams. Danny Dewson took the ball in what was supposed to be the afternoon half of a twi-nighter, but the world as it applied to the Titans had already gone to hell. We just didn't know it. No one did except for Joe DiPunno. By the time night fell, we knew we were fucked for the season because our first 22 games were almost surely going to be erased from the record books, along with any official acknowledgement of Blockade Billy Blakely. I got in late because of traffic, but figured it didn't matter because the uniform snafu was sorted out. Most of the guys were already there, dressing or playing poker or just sitting around shooting the shit. Dewson and the kid were over in the corner by the cigarette machine, sitting in a couple of folding chairs, the kid with his uniform pants on. Dewson still wearing nothing but his jock. Not a pretty sight. I went over to get a pack of Winston's and listened in. Danny was doing most of the talking. "That fucking Wenders hates my ass," he says. "He hates your ass," the kid says, then adds, "That fucker." "You bet he is. You think he wants to be the one behind the plate when I get my 200th? "No," the kid says. "You bet he don't. But I'm going to win today just despite him. And you're going to help me, Bill. Right?" "Right. Sure, Bill's going to help. He'll squeeze like a motherfucker." "Will he? Will he squeeze like a motherfucker? I just said he will. So you pull everything back." "I'll pull everything back. You're my good luck charm, Billy boy." And the kid grinning, "I'm your good luck charm." "Yeah, now listen." It was funny and creepy at the same time. The dude was intense, leaning forward, eyes flashing while he talked. Everything Wenders had said about him was true, but he left one thing out. The dude was a competitor. He wanted to win, the way Bob Gibson did. Like Gibby, he'd do anything he could get away with to make that happen. And the kid was eating it up with a spoon. I almost said something because I wanted to break up that connection. Talking about it to you, I think maybe my subconscious mind had already put a lot of it together. Maybe that's bullshit. But I don't think so. In any case, I left him alone, just got my butts and walked away. Hell, if I'd opened my bazoo, Dewson would have told me to put a sock in it anyway. He didn't like to be interrupted when he was holding court. And while I might not have given much of a shit about that on any other day, you tend to leave a guy alone when it's his turn to toe the rubber in front of the 40,000 people who are paying his salary, especially when he's up for the big 200. I went over to Joe's office to get the lineup card, but the office door was shut and the blinds were down. An almost unheard of thing on a game day. The slats weren't closed, so I peeked through. Joe had the phone to his ear and one hand over his eyes. I knocked on the glass. He started so hard he almost fell out of his chair, then looked around, and I saw he was crying. I never saw him cry in my life. Not before or after. But he was crying that day. His face was pale and his hair was wild. What little hair he had. He waved me away, then went back to talking on the phone. I started across the locker room to the coach's office, which was really the equipment room. Halfway there, I stopped. The big pitcher-catcher conference had broken up and the kid was pulling on his uniform shirt, the one with the big blue 19. And I saw the Band-Aid was back on the second finger of his right hand. I walked over and put a hand on his shoulder. He smiled at me. The kid had a real sweet smile when he used it. "Hi, Granny," he says. But his smile began to fade when he saw I wasn't smiling back. "You all ready to play?" I asked. "Sure." "Good. But I want to tell you something first. The dude's a hell of a pitcher. But as a human being, he ain't ever going to get past double A. He'd walk on his grandmother's broken back to get a win. And you matter a hell of a lot less to him than his grandmother." "I'm his good luck charm," he says indignantly. But underneath the indignation, he looked ready to cry. "Maybe so," I said, "but that's not what I'm talking about. There's such a thing as getting too pumped up for a game. A little is good, but too much and a fellow's apt to bust wide open. I don't get you. If you popped and went flat like a bad tire, the dude wouldn't give much of a shit. He'd just find himself a brand new lucky charm." "You shouldn't talk like that. Him and me's friends." "I'm your friend, too. More important, I'm one of the coaches on this team. I'm responsible for your welfare, and I'll talk any goddamn way I want, especially to a rook, and you'll listen. Are you listening?" "I'm listening." I'm sure he was, but he wasn't looking. He'd cast his eyes down, and sullen red roses were blooming on those smooth little boy cheeks of his. "I don't know what kind of a rig you've got under that Band-Aid, and I don't want to know. All I know is I saw it in the first game you played for us, and somebody got hurt. I haven't seen it since, and I don't want to see it today, because if you got caught, it'd be you caught, not the do." "I just cut myself," he says, all sullen. "Right, shaving. But I don't want to see it on your finger when you go out there. I'm looking after your own best interests." Would I have said that if I hadn't seen Joe so upset he was crying? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think I was also looking after the best interests of the game, which I loved then and now. Virtual bowling can't hold a candle, believe me. I walked away before he could say anything else, and I didn't look back, partly because I didn't want to see what was under the Band-Aid. Mostly because Joe was standing in his office door beckoning to me. I won't swear there was more gray in his hair, but I won't swear there wasn't. I came into the office and closed the door. An awful idea occurred to me. It made a kind of sense, given the look on his face. "Jesus, Joe, is it your wife? Or the kids? Did something happen to one of the kids?" He started like I'd just woken him out of a dream.
"Jesse and the kids are fine. But George, oh God, I can't believe it. This is such a mess."
And he put the heels of his palms against his eyes. A sound came out of him, but it wasn't a sob. It was a laugh. The most terrible fucked up laugh I ever heard.
"What is it? Who called you?" "I have to think," he says, but not to me. It was himself he was talking to. "I have to decide. How am I going to?"
He took his hands off his eyes, and he seemed a little more like himself.
"You're managing today, Granny."
"Me? I can't manage. The dude would blow his stack. He's going for his 200th again, and..."
"None of that matters. Don't you see? Not now."
"What?"
"Just shut up and make out a lineup card. As for that kid..."
He thought, then shook his head.
"Oh, hell, let him play. Why not? Shit. Bat him fifth. I was going to move him up anyway."
"Of course he's going to play," I said. "Who else would catch Danny?"
"Oh, fuck Danny Deuson," he says.
"Cap. Joey, tell me what happened."
"No," he says. "I gotta think about it first. What I'm gonna say to the guys. And the reporters."
He slapped his brow as if this part of it had just occurred to him.
"Those overbred assholes. Shit!
Then, talking to himself again. But let the guys have this game. They deserve that much. Maybe the kid, too. Hell, maybe he'll bat for the cycle. He laughed some more, then went upside his own head to make himself stop. I don't understand.
You will. Go on, get out of here. Make any old lineup you want. Pull the names out of a hat, why don't you? It doesn't matter. Only make sure you tell the umpire crew chief you're running the show. I guess that'd be Winders.
I walked down the hall to the umpire's room like a man in a dream and told Winders that I'd be making out the lineup and managing the game from the third base box. He asked me what was wrong with Joe, and I said Joe was sick. That was the first game I managed until I got the Athletics in 63, and it was a short one, because, as you probably know if you've done your research, High Wenders ran me in the sixth. I don't remember much about it anyway. I had so much on my mind that I felt like a man in a dream. But I did have sense enough to do one thing, and that was to check the kid's right hand before he ran out on the field. There was no Band-Aid on the second finger, and no cut either. I didn't even feel relieved. I just kept seeing Joe DiPunno's red eyes and haggard mouth. That was Danny Dew's last good game ever, and he never did get his 200. He tried to come back in 58, but it was no good. He claimed the double vision was gone, and maybe it was true, but he couldn't hardly get the pill over the plate anymore. No spot in Cooperstown for Danny. Joe was right. That kid did suck luck. But that afternoon, Dew was the best I ever saw him. His fastball hopping, his curve snapping like a whip. For the first four innings, they couldn't touch him at all. Just wave the stick and take a seat, fellas. He struck out six, and the rest were infield groundouts. Only trouble was Kinder was almost as good. We'd gotten one lousy hit, a two-out double by Harrington in the bottom of the third. Now, it's the top of the fifth. The first batter goes down easy. Then Walt Dropo comes up, hits one deep into the left field corner, and takes off like a bat out of hell. The crowd saw Harry Keene still chasing the ball while Dropo's legging for second, and they understood it could be an inside-the-park job. The chanting started. Only a few voices at first, then more and more, getting deeper and louder. It put a chill up me from the crack of my ass to the nape of my neck. Blockade! 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 Like that. The orange signs started going up. People were on their feet and holding them over their heads. Not waving them like usual, just holding them up. I have never seen anything like it. Blockade! 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 At first, I thought there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell. By then, Dropo's steaming for third with all the stops pulled out. But Keene pounced on the ball and made a perfect throw to Barbarino at short. The Rook, meanwhile, is standing on the third base side of home plate with his glove held out, making a target, and Cy hit the goddamn pocket. The crowd's chanting. Dropo's sliding, spikes up. The kid don't mind. He goes on his knees and dives over him. High Wenders was where he was supposed to be, that time at least, leaning over the play. A cloud of dust goes up. And out of it comes Wenders' upraised thumb. You're out! Mr. King, the fans went nuts! Walt Dropo did, too. He was up and dancing around like a coked-up kid at a record hop. He couldn't believe it! The kid was scraped halfway up his left forearm. Not bad, just blood sweat. But enough for old Boney Dadier, he was our trainer, to come out and slap a Band-Aid on it. So the kid got his Band-Aid after all, only this one was legit. The fans stayed on their feet during the whole medical consultation, waving their road closed signs and chanting, Blockade! Blockade! Like they wouldn't ever get enough of it. The kid didn't seem to notice.
He was in another world. He was the whole time he was with the Titans, now that I think of it. He just put on his mask, went back behind the plate, and squatted down, business as usual. Bubba Phillips came up, lined out to Lathrop at first, and that was the fifth. When the kid came up in the bottom of the inning and struck out on three pitches, the crowd still gave him a standing O. That time, he noticed and tipped his cap when he went back to the dugout, only time he ever did it. Not because he was snotty, but because, well, I already said it, that other world thing. Okay, top of the sixth. Over 50 years later, and I still get a red ass when I think of it. Kinder's up first and loops out to third, just like a pitcher should. Then comes Louis Aparicio, little Louis. The dew whines and fires. Aparicio fouls it off, high and lazy behind home plate on the third base side of the screen. The kid throws away his mask and sprints after it, head back and glove out. Wenders trailed him, but not close like he should have done. He didn't think the kid had a chance. It was lousy goddamn umping. The kid's off the grass and on the track by the low wall between the field and the box seats, neck craned, looking up. 2 dozen people in those first and second row box seats also looking up, most of them waving their hands in the air. You know, this is one thing I don't understand about fans, and never will. It's a fucking baseball, for the love of God. An item that sold for 75 cents back then. Everybody knew it, but when fans see one in reach at the ballpark, they turn into fucking Danny Dew in order to get their hands on it. Never mind standing back and letting the man trying to catch it, their man, and in a tight ball game, do his job. I saw it all. Saw it clear. That mile-high pop-up came down on our side of the wall. The kid was going to catch it. Then some long-armed bozo in one of those Titans jerseys they sold on the Esplanade reached over and ticked it so the ball bounced off the edge of the kid's glove and fell to the ground. I was so sure Wenders would call Aparicio out. It was clear interference. That at first I couldn't believe what I was seeing when he gestured for the kid to go back behind the plate and for Aparicio to resume the box. When I got it, I ran out waving my arms. The crowd started cheering me and booing Wenders, which is no way to win friends and influence people when you're arguing a call, but I was too goddamn mad to care. I wouldn't have stopped if Mahatma Gandhi had walked out on the field butt naked and urging us to make peace. "Interference!" I yelled. "Clear as day, clear as the nose on your face!" "It was in the stands, and that makes it anyone's ball," Wenders says. "Go on back to your little nest, and let's get this show on the road." The kid didn't care. He was talking to his pal, the Dew. That was all right. I didn't care that he didn't care. All I wanted at that moment was to tear High Wenders a fresh new asshole. I'm not ordinarily an argumentative man. All the years I managed the A's, I only got thrown out of games twice. But that day, I would have made Billy Martin look like a peacenik. "You didn't see it, High. You were trailing too far back. You didn't see shit." "I wasn't trailing, and I saw it all. Now get back, Granny. I ain't kidding." "If you didn't see that long-armed son of a bitch..." Here, a lady in the second row put her hands over her little boy's ears and pursed up her mouth at me in an "oh, you nasty man" look. "That long-armed son of a bitch reach out and tick that ball? You were goddamn trailing! Jesus Christ!" The man in the jersey starts shaking his head. "Who, me? Not me." But he's also wearing a big, embarrassed, suck-ass grin. Wenders saw it, knew what it meant. Then looked away. "That's it," he says to me, and in the reasonable voice that means you're one smart crack from drinking a Rheingold in the locker room. "You've had your say. Now you can either go back to the dugout, or you can listen to the rest of the game on the radio. Take your pick." I went back to the dugout. Aparicio stood back in with a big shit-eating grin on his face. He knew, sure he did, and made the most of it. The guy never hit many home runs, but when the Dew sent in a changeup that didn't change, Louis cranked it,
high, wide, and handsome to the deepest part of the park. Nosey Norton was playing center, and he never even turned around. Aparicio circled the bases, serene as the Queen Mary coming in to dock, while the crowd screamed at him, denigrated his relatives, and hurled hate down on High Wender's head. Wender's heard none of it, which is the chief umpirely skill. He just got a fresh ball out of his coat pocket and inspected it for dings and doinks. Watching him do that, I lost it entirely. I rushed out to home plate and started shaking both fists in his face. "That's your run, you fucking busher," I screamed. "Too fucking lazy to chase after a foul ball, and now you've got an RBI for yourself. Jam it up your ass! Maybe you'll find your glasses!" The crowd loved it. High Wenders, not so much. He pointed at me, threw his thumb back over his shoulder, and walked away. The crowd started booing and shaking their road closed signs. Some threw bottles, cups, and half-eaten Franks onto the field. It was a circus. "Don't you walk away from me, you fat-ass, blind, lazy, son-of-a-bitching bastard!" I screamed and chased after him. Someone from our dugout grabbed me before I could grab Wenders, which I meant to do. I had lost touch with reality. The crowd was chanting, "Kill the ump! Kill the ump! Kill the ump!" I'll never forget that, because it was the same way they'd been chanting, "Blockade! Blockade!" "If your mother was here, she'd be throwing shit at you too, you bat-blind busher!" I screamed, and then they hauled me into the dugout. Gansey Burgess, our knuckleballer, managed the last three innings of that horror show. He also pitched the last two. You might find that in the record books, too, if there were any records of that lost spring. The last thing I saw on the field was Danny Dewson and Blockade Billy standing on the grass between the plate and the mound. The kid had his mask tucked under his arm. The dew was whispering in his ear. The kid was listening. He always listened when the dew talked. But he was looking at the crowd. 40,000 fans on their feet, men, women, and children, yelling, "Kill the ump! Kill the ump! Kill the ump!" There was a bucket of balls halfway down the hall between the dugout and the locker room. I kicked it and sent balls rolling every which way. If I'd stepped on one of them and fallen on my ass, it would have been the perfect end to a perfect fucking afternoon at the ballpark. Joe was in the locker room, sitting on a bench outside the showers. By then, he looked 70 instead of just 50. There were three other guys in there with him. Two were uniformed cops. The third was in a suit, but you only had to take one look at his hard roast beef of a face to know he was a cop, too. "Game over early?" this one asked me. He was sitting on a folding chair with his big old cop thighs spread and straining his seersucker pants. The blue suits were on one of the benches in front of the lockers. "It is for me," I said. I was still so mad I didn't even care about the cops. To Joe, I said, "Fucking Wenders ran me. I'm sorry, Cap, but it was a clear case of interference, and that lazy son of a bitch..."
"It doesn't matter," Joe said. "The game isn't going to count. I don't think any of our games are going to count. Kerwin will appeal to the commissioner, of course, but..."
"What are you talking about?" I asked. Joe sighed. Then he looked at the guy in the suit.
"You tell him, Detective Lombardazzi," he said. "I can't bear to."
"Does he need to know?" Lombardazzi asked. "He's looking at me like I'm some kind of bug he's never seen before." It was a look I didn't need on top of everything else, but I kept my mouth shut. Because I knew three cops, one of them a detective, don't show up in the locker room of a Major League Baseball team if it isn't goddamn serious.
"If you want him to hold the other guys long enough for you to get the Blakely kid out of here, I think he does need to," Joe says.
From above us there came a cry from the fans, followed by a groan, followed by a cheer. None of us paid any attention to what turned out to be the end of Danny Dewson's baseball career. The cry was when he got hit in the forehead by a Larry Doby line drive. The groan was when he fell on the pitcher's mound like a tagged prize fighter, and the cheer was when he picked himself up and gestured that he was okay, which he was not. But he pitched the rest of the sixth and the seventh, too. Didn't give up a run, either. Gansey made him come out before the eighth when he saw the Dew wasn't walking straight. Danny all the time claiming he was perfectly okay, that the big purple goose egg raising up over his left eyebrow was nothing. He'd had lots worse. And the kids saying the same. It ain't nothing. It ain't nothing. Little Sir Echo. Us, down in the clubhouse, didn't know any of that. No more than Deuson knew he might have been tagged worse in his career, but it was the first time part of his brain had sprung a leak. His name isn't Blakely, Lombardozzi says. It's Eugene Katsanis. Katswatsis? Where's Blakely, then? William Blakely's dead. Has been for a month. His parents, too. I gaped at him. What are you talking about? So he told me the stuff I'm sure you already know, Mr. King. But maybe I can fill in a few blanks. The Blakeleys lived in Clarence, Iowa, a wide patch of not much an hour's drive from Davenport. Made it convenient for Ma and Pa because they could go to most of their son's minor league games. Blakely had a successful farm, an 800-acre job. One of their hired men wasn't much more than a boy. His name was Gene Katsanis, an orphan who'd grown up in the Ottershaw Christian Home for Boys. He was no farmer, and not quite right in the head, but he was a hell of a baseball player. Katsanis and Blakely played against each other on a couple of church teams, and together on the local Babe Ruth team, which won the state tournament all 3 years the two of them played together, and once went as far as the national semis. Blakely went to high school and starred on that team, too, but Katsanis wasn't school material. Slopping the hogs material and ball-playing material is what he was, although he was never supposed to be as good as Billy Blakely. Nobody so much as considered such a thing. Until it happened, that is. Blakely's father hired him because the kid worked cheap, sure, but mostly because he had enough natural talent to keep Billy sharp. For $25 a week, the kid got a fielder and a batting practice pitcher. The old man got a cow milker and a shit shoveler. Not a bad deal, at least for them. Whatever you've found in your research probably favors the Blakely family. Am I right? Because they had been around those parts for four generations, because they were rich farmers, and because Katsanis wasn't nothing but a state kid who started life in a liquor carton on a church step and had several screws loose upstairs. And why was that? Because he was born dumb? Or because he got the crap beaten out of him 3 and 4 times a week in that home before he got old enough and big enough to defend himself? I know a lot of the beatings came because he had a habit of talking to himself. That came out in the newspapers later on. Katsanis and Billy practiced just as hard once Billy got into the Titans farm system. During the off-season, you know, probably throwing and hitting in the barn once the snow got too deep outside. But Katsanis got kicked off the local town team and wasn't allowed to go to the cornholers' workouts during Billy's second season with them. During his first one, Katsanis had been allowed to participate in some of the workouts, even in some inter-squad games, if they were a man shy. It was all pretty informal and loosey-goosey back then, not like now, when the insurance company shit a brick if a major leaguer so much as grabs a bat without wearing a helmet. What I think happened, feel free to correct me if you know better, is that the kid, whatever other problems he might have had, continued to grow and mature as a ball player. Blakely didn't. You see that all the time. Two kids who both looked like Babe fucking Ruth in high school. Same height, same weight, same speed, same 20-20 peepers, but one of them is able to play at the next level. And the next, while the other one starts to fall behind. This much I did hear later. Billy Blakely didn't start out as a catcher. He got switched from center field when the kid who was catching broke his arm.
And that kind of switch isn't a real good sign. It's like the coach is sending a message, you'll do, but only until someone better shows up. I think Blakely got jealous. I think his old man got jealous. And I think maybe Mom did too. Maybe especially Mom. Because sports moms can be the worst. I think maybe they pulled a few strings to keep Katsana.